Welcome to the Victory Show.
Hey, Victors. Welcome to this episode of the Victory Show. If this is the first time you're joining us, I'm Travis Cody, best-selling author of 19 books and the creator of Bestseller by Design. I've had the privilege of helping hundreds of business consultants, founders, entrepreneurs write and publish their own best-selling books. And through that journey, I've discovered a fascinating pattern. Most businesses really struggle to break past 7 figures per year in revenue. So on this show, we sit down with some of the world's most successful founders, CEOs, leaders, and business owners to uncover the strategies they use to scale past that mark so you can do the same. So get ready for some deep insights and actionable takeaways that you can implement in your life and business starting now. Today's guest has spent over 15 years living at crossroads of sport, strategy, and startup ambitions. Norman DeSilva is a veteran NBA coach and scout whose journey began in the Boston area and took him from the sidelines and scouting tables of the NBA to founding his own startup. Armed with a finance degree from Babson College, Norman blends his deep analytical training with a love for the game, serving as an advanced scout for teams like the Boston Celtics, Philadelphia 76ers, and more. Now, he channels that same elite-level insight into his own company, Listed, spelled L-I-S-T-I-D. Listed is the first product that allows home buyers to purchase using equity rather than debt. Using equity cuts the cost of home ownership by up to 50% and keeps buyers completely debt-free. So whether you're a coach, a founder, or just someone trying to level up with focus and purpose, this is a conversation you are going to want to hear. Norman, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So I'm always just curious because you got a degree in finance, but then you ended up as a basketball coach and scout. How did that happen?
Oh boy, I wish I knew. So got the finance degree from Babson College. Right as I left, we were walking into the financial crisis. So 2008, 2009.
Fantastic timing.
Yeah. So thrown right into the fire. So I said to myself, I know quite a bit more about basketball, or at least, 20 years worth at that point.
Did you play for Babson?
I did. I played at Babson. Basketball was my passion. So I said, well, while this finance world kind of figures itself out over the next year or two, why don't I give it a shot in the basketball world? Because if I don't, I'd probably be kicking myself later on. So I did. And I usually don't give up that easily. So unfortunately, 15 years later, I'm still here.
Wow. Okay. All right. So walk me through just a little bit about your journey. Like, so you started off coaching like NBA Discovery Leagues?
Yeah. So I was interning for Tim Grover, who's Michael Jordan's trainer out in Chicago. Did 4 years with Tim.
Wow.
He's the best of the best.
I was gonna say that gives you some insights at a high level.
Yeah, similar to my time in the D League with Tim, he kind of runs a small operation. He doesn't let a lot of people in. So there were a lot of hats to wear. There was a lot of learning and a lot of real world experience that I could put on that resume where you don't usually get it if you went and started interning at Goldman Sachs or somewhere, right? Wow. So from there, got a job in the NBA Development League called the D League, which is now called the G League. For Gatorade, their sponsorship of the NBA minor league. But
that's funny.
Similarly, there were a lot of small staffs. It was small operations. I was doing everything from driving vans to, drawing things up in timeouts and doing actual coaching. So from there, I ended up coaching overseas, 1 year in China, 1 year in Japan, consulting in Spain. And then came back to the States for the 76ers during the Trust the Process era. If fans know anything about that, where with the 76ers, we were trying to get bad in order to get good, and spent a few years there and then kind of transitioned into scouting. So advanced scouting, personnel scouting, things of that nature. And this kind of led me into the world of interacting a little bit with team ownership and some high level people in different areas, and one thing leads to another, an idea gets thrown across the table, and now we're chasing it down. So
that's fantastic. So and I want to dive into Listed in a minute, but let's talk a little bit about, so I'm on the show, obviously we're talking about business growth, and one of the questions I've asked eight-figure business owners, like what's the, you know, some of the guys that have been on my show that have their own funds, like, okay, as an investor, you know, what's the thing that ruins companies, you know, from keeps them from scaling? And 90% of them have said the owner not being able to let go of wearing all the hats. They want to do it for themselves. So what I want to do, I want to talk a little bit about basketball and leadership in basketball. And like, and I would love to just hear your thoughts about sort of the comparisons of like how that translates into the business world. Cause I have a feeling that there's probably some things business owners could learn if they were a coach that many of them seem to be missing.
Yeah, for sure. I think you definitely nailed it there. There's on the way up, you're learning and you're kind of wearing all the hats, right? And you're figuring out every little aspect of every way the thing that the whole works. And then when you get to the top of the hole, if you still try to do that, it's impossible. And so kind of being able to trust others, putting an emphasis on, you know, who's on your team, what hats they wear, right? And focusing on what they need rather than trying to do everything yourself. I think that's really sound advice. As far as the coaching overlap, I would say there was a portion there where I was reading a book about Thomas Jefferson. I think it was the John Meacham book on Thomas Jefferson. And it was right in the middle of the season. And it was something just to get yourself out of basketball a little bit so you can get back in, right? You become so obsessed and tunnel vision. And somebody had asked me, like, why would you waste your time reading about Thomas Jefferson when you could be reading about getting better at your craft? And I was kind of taken back and realized, oh my gosh, yeah, everybody just thinks that the craft is the craft and that's it. However, there's so much to learn from other areas. So in my estimation, I was like, yeah, I'm a basketball coach, but I'm, for the very first time, I was a head coach, and I'm trying to lead a group of people toward a common cause. And like, how could you learn about that better than somebody like a Thomas Jefferson or the Revolution or throughout history, people who have rallied others around a cause which was not popular for whatever different reasons or self-interest. So I think there's a lot to learn, whether it be from basketball about entrepreneurship or from about history about basketball. There's so much overlap in really gathering people and getting them in the right direction, all headed towards the same end goal. So with that in mind, I guess I'll
let's talk about dealing with, like, so you've got you know, there's the multiple things there, right? You got dealing with egos is one part, right? So there's how do we deal with that? Like, how did you, you know, motivate people when, like, maybe the season wasn't going good, right? Things are down. People have a tendency to, like, get stuck in this, you know? So I would love to talk about a little bit about dealing with star egos, because companies have that, you know, especially if you're a company that's got sales and one guy is doing better than everyone else. You know, I see, being in the NBA, I'm sure you've seen your share of, you know, guys that are the leaders having, you know, some interesting expectations around the way things should be done. Right. And how do we navigate that?
So I've found that a lot of the model in the NBA that works right now is probably not the best, but it works for a short period of time. And that is kind of placating to the personalities of the people who have the most power. Right. So players, unfortunately, have a lot more power than the coaches these days. And so the coaches placate to that as a survival mechanism. And I kind of took the opposite of approach. Now, I wasn't an NBA head coach, so it's a little easier for me to say that. When I was a head coach, I was in China. I was dealing with, you know, guys who were just fresh off the NBA or trying to get back. So like Rashad McCants, Deron Perkins, Shavlik Randolph, guys that are on the verge. So they're big personalities. Rashad is one of the biggest. But I found that placating them is not a long-term strategy. And I think Jack Welch kind of coined the term radical candor, I think, or something to that effect, which is there's this belief that like everyone's self-interest don't align, right? Everyone wants to score 30. Everyone wants to be the star, obviously. And that's not necessarily what's in everyone's best interest. So trying to get player A and player, you know, player D on the same page that, hey, player A, yes, it's important for you to, you know, be the guy on this team, right? And player D, it's really important for you to be a guy who only averages 7 points and does these specific things. That is in your best long-term interest, because the best interest for you personally is the best interest of the team, right? So in the scouting world, if we're evaluating players, I would much more highly value a player who's the fifth or sixth option on a championship team versus the second or third option on one of the worst teams in the league. So the interests of the individual are the interests of the team almost all the time, right? I haven't found a scenario where that's not true. So trying to get them to realize that, and whatever their role is on that team, getting them to be the starter in that role, right? So I think it was Austin Eckler with the San Diego Chargers kind of said this, and it stuck with me. And it was, he's kind of like the third down back, right? Or the guy that comes in, he's not the main running back. And he said, well, I'm the starter in that role, meaning I am the only person on planet Earth that is the third down back for the San Diego Chargers, right? That's mine. I own it. So just because it's not the role that you maybe want, own the one that you have. And then when you do get the role you want, you'll be prepared for it, or you'll have those opportunities, right? You won't self-destruct and, you know, try to do things that you can't do or that are beyond what you're asked to do. And those kind of usually hinder people. So it's a long way, I guess, of saying getting people aligned to the same goal. It starts with the truth, right? You have to be really find the, not the less harsh way of saying the truth, but just find the truth, whatever it is, and explain to them, even if it takes an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours of sitting down going through, this is why this is in your best interest from the long term, rather than lying to them and say, hey, just that, you know, that guy's going to be, you know, missing next week and you're going to be able to take on a bigger role in the short term in the future, or, you know, this might happen or that might happen, which is going to be a breaker. It's nonsense. They can see through it. Or the excuses or the reasons why they don't have the role that they think they should have and you're going to deliver it for them. No, just tell them where you think they are. Explain to them your reasoning, right? Just be completely open. I think they respond to that better than, you know, just the short-term fixes. Those things seem to blow up in the long term.
That's so interesting. So how would you go about as a coach keeping people motivated, especially when things weren't going your way?
You got to get creative, right? That's where the entrepreneur comes out, right? So whether you set different benchmarks, or Brett Brown in Philadelphia used to break the season up into 10 groups of 10 games, right? So we're going to win the first 10 games. That's all we're focused on. 10 games right now, right? What's our record after those 10? We're going to reevaluate roles, statistics, things like that. So kind of gamifying smaller segments of a season. There's all kinds of different ways, and everyone's different, right? Kobe Bryant always talks about finding out what really he ended up becoming passionate about toward the end of his career was finding out which buttons make which people click, right? Or those make those gears turn, right? For some guy, the motivation is their family. For the other guy, the motivation is, you know, statistical success or whatever. And maybe you have to help realign what those things are. But once you find them, that's where you press, right? So everybody's different. You got to try to work with them individually. I think the idea of, you know, I treat everyone the same is kind of foolish and a little outdated. You do have to have some sort of standards, but not everyone is the same, right? I first coach I ever worked for at the University of New Haven would always say, you have to be better than your problems, right? So if this guy's not showing up to class, but he averages 35 a game and he's all league, we got to get him to go to class, but we're not going to kick him off the team, right? Or we're not going to have him run at 4 a.m. when maybe the guy who's a walk-on and not going to class and goofing off, he's going to go run at 4 a.m. So maybe that's not the best example, because you do want to have standards, right? You want to hold everyone accountable. However, you got to pick your spots. And I think the NBA is unbelievably good at that. College and lower levels aren't as good at it. A relative term, but I think it's not as common at lower levels because the players don't carry as much weight, right? If you're the best player on the NBA team, you're worth hundreds of millions of dollars, right? If you're the best player on your high school team, you know, you might be playing basketball for another 10 minutes before your career is over. So it's not the same, but nice. Yeah, standards change for different people. They earn different standards, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I would love to just have a couple insights on like behind the scenes of NBA scouting? What's one or two things that a layperson like me that doesn't know anything about behind the scenes to the professional sports might surprise me? Like, what really goes on?
Yeah, I would say the things that everybody miss are the how we evaluate people. I think we're thought of as people. We're evaluating players, right? Now we're evaluating people. We want to know what makes that person, right? We had a guy named Rod Baker in Philadelphia, and he was look, Google him. He's fantastic. But we used to call him like the Navy SEAL of scouts because we'd drop him onto a college campus, and he'd walk away with information about that person that you couldn't get anywhere else, right? And everything from talking to their not just Rod, but scouts in general, talk to their elementary school teachers, talk to their high school teachers, talk to the people in town that knew him, or whatever it is. You're going to try to find insights to what makes that person tick, what makes them motivated. Are they motivated? Are they self-motivated? Do they get motivated by external factors? How do they perform under pressure? How do they perform when their family life falls apart? All of these things are just as important, or at least important enough to be in the conversation compared to, how does he shoot his one dribble to the left pick pull up jump shot? Or what's his 3-point percentage on the left side of the court or the right side of the court, or all those metrics. So we're really investing in people, and I think that gets lost a lot of the
Yeah.
time. That would be the first thing. And then I guess the other is just everything is data. So to a fault and to a credit. So every time a general manager speaks, every time a coach speaks, every time a player speaks, that's data, right? We start to know what they think. Now it could be useless, right? Or it could be they slip up and they tell you something really important in an interview that's on a local network TV station. So like all of that's data, and we have a lot of resources dedicated to compiling that, valuing it. That might seem
That's so bizarre.
psychotic, right? But for example, I'm working for a team, and we found out that another team who picked two picks after us in the NBA draft was enamored with a player. Every time they spoke in public, gave an interview about this college player, they were off the charts excited about this player. So we had a value score that says, hey, blinking red, this team loves this player. We took that player at 10. And then the second we took him, the phone rang and said, what do you want? What do you want? They basically gave us a first round pick to move two spots in the draft to get the player that they wanted. And we got the guy that we basically wanted at 12 anyway. So
And the only reason you knew that is because somebody was watching him doing interviews going, they keep talking about this guy.
everything is information. When guys are out there and general managers and coaches are doing press conferences, I understand why they're short with their words, because information is power, knowledge is power. So I would say that's something that
I
might
feel
be
like I want to make a
interesting.
movie of like just the like the guy that's behind the scenes just watch it. It's like a thriller where like Kobe says two words and like, oh my God, we know what they're going to do the next game.
And it's usually not what you think. It's
Right.
usually a 150-pound kid who went to MIT and doesn't really know how to hold a basketball, right? So it could be.
They throw that's just a throwaway line that nobody thinks of, but it means something. That's funny.
Yeah, it's not always the characters that you think that they don't look like what you think they might look like.
So when you were working with Michael Jordan's coach, what's one or two sort of really high level things you picked up from working with a guy that worked at kind of that level?
If you were to go search Tim Grover right now, you'll find a treasure trove of snippets and clips of him speaking. And he's just a wealth of knowledge and information in terms of self-motivation, what separates winners from losers. I would encourage everybody to go read his books, watch his speeches, or his talks. And a couple of things maybe that stood out there were just the balance between things that are sexy and things that you really need, right? So let's say I have an hour to work with a player on the court. The player's gonna get bored if I don't give them something interesting and new to learn, right? But that can really only be a small percentage of what they're there to do, because what they're there to really do is work, right? They need to do reps and get beat over the head with the same thing over and over, maybe different ways of doing the same thing, keeping them engaged and finding creative ways to get the same thing accomplished that looks different, right? Or that's a different scenario where they have to think a little bit. But I think he let me know early on, like, hey, Norm, that's all great, and you can beat him over the head with this repetition, but you got to give him a little snippet of something interesting that keeps him coming back, right? Because they're still clients too, right? And this is how he and a lot of trainers get paid. So you got to balance that. And some trainers do the complete opposite, and they're teaching them moves that they have no use for, right? Between the legs, hesitation, spin move, half spin, step through, dream shake. And it's like, well, when are you ever going to use that? But the player is excited and they feel like they've done something. They learned some secret weapon that nobody else has but them. Okay. So not doing that to excess, but giving the player something that they feel like, gives them a little bit of an edge and isn't just monotonous, boring repetition all the time. I think Brad Stevens used to call it dream time when he was at Butler. He would give his guys, a segment of practice. Hey, you're going to go work on something that you probably have no business working on, that you should put into your game, that you want to add to your game someday, but maybe you're not ready to, right? Whether it's a move, whether it's if you're a rebounder, primarily, and you want to work on your ball handling, whatever it is that's going to keep them engaged in that kind of, hope and a little bit of excitement kind of
Yeah,
keeps everybody on board.
well, so what's interesting about that is, like, the business sort of correlation of that is what Google was doing for the longest time, where, with their engineers, they would give them Friday off. Hey, we're going to
Exactly.
pay you for Friday, but come in and you work on whatever you want.
Right.
Right. And
And
so
some
it's
of
sort
those
of,
things turn into things that we use there, right? Like those little dream time sessions turn into, oh, wow, that's a really good idea. We should do something with that.
So what's so fascinating about your story is that you're starting off in finance, you come out in like a crappy market that pushes you into the NBA, but then that ends up putting you into a position that you have access to a level of people that most people don't. So when you get this new idea for listed, now you're full circle back to kind of where you started, and like you're like, oh, it's 16 years, I gotta go blow off the dust off of my finance degree. And so let's talk about listed. I like the concept of this is amazing. So first off, I'd love to, when did the idea for listed start sort of forming for you?
It was in that 2008, 2009 era, right?
All the
Because
way back then. Wow.
the thing that was necessarily the seed that caused that was the subprime and basically this mortgage industry, right?
Yep.
Mortgage-backed securities. Anybody who's watched The Big Short, it's a fascinating time in history. So started doing the entrepreneurial Babson-esque thing, which is pushing areas, asking questions. Why did this fail? Why does that work? Why do we do this the way we do it? And that kind of led to a lot of conversations with some of my friends and classmates at Babson. And this was an idea that we kicked around for a while. And once I did start to have access, this was like, hey, shoot your shot with these billionaires and see if this is an idea that has legs or if it's just, something, just an idea that we were kicking around. So, did that. Turns out it was a pretty good idea or so far. And, yeah, that's what we're chasing down. That's kind of how it came about.
So walk me through the principle of w listed, and why is this sort of such a disruptor for the real estate market?
Yeah. So what we're trying to do is get people to stop thinking about purchasing expensive assets through debt and start thinking about equity as an option. So equity financing in place of debt financing. Now, anybody who's watched Shark Tank knows that when you go in there and you're trying to raise money for a venture that costs a lot of money, you have two things that you can do. You could take a loan from that shark, which is debt, and you're going to have to pay that shark back with interest. Right? That's a pretty expensive way to do it. Or you could give them a share of equity in your company. Right? And so what that says is, hey, we're not going to pay you back right away. But in the end, when this thing works out, you're going to get a real nice share of the success. So that's the concept. We're looking at home buyers. The asset price is way too high compared to what they actually have in terms of purchasing power. So what would an entrepreneur do in that scenario? They would finance the home the same way a startup finances, right? Let's sell that difference. Let's sell that equity to somebody who wants to invest in that asset and hopefully see that asset appreciate over time.
So, well, how so? Like, walk me through the real world of like, how does that act? So, let's say I'm a home buyer and I want to engage in this. Like, how does that work? How's that process work?
So traditionally, you go to a bank. Let's
Sure.
say it's $1 million house, just for round numbers,
Got to
and
come up with
you've
my 300,000 down payment.
right. Let's give you a little. I hope that we all could have 300,000, but I don't think many do. So
No.
let's say it's 100,000. Okay, 10% down. The other 90 or 90%, 900,000. You'd go to a bank. They'd say, "We'll give you the 900,000, but you're going to pay us back." And over 30 years, you're probably going to pay us back closer to like $2 million, right? When you compound the interest. What we're saying is don't go to the bank. They're a debt originator. Come to an equity originator like us. We will give you the 900,000. We'll purchase the property in cash. And what you're doing there is you're trading off that long-term appreciation to us in exchange for a monthly payment that's going to be half of whatever a mortgage payment would be. So what you're doing, and when you're making that monthly payment to us, to the equity holder, that's really a dividend payment, right? You're the company, you're the person who owns and operates the
Oh,
asset,
fascinating.
and you're going to pay a dividend to all your outstanding shareholders, which is us. And dividend rates, as anybody in finance kind of knows, are always usually a lot lower than interest rates. So if we can get a dividend that's close to the 10-year yield on the 10-year treasury, something 4% lower than that maybe. That's going to be significantly lower than a 7% or 8% mortgage interest rate.
Wow.
So the idea is you're going to get a more affordable now for a little bit more expensive later, but it at least gets you in the property. And when I say expensive, you're not going to have to come up with the cash. It's just going to be when that property liquidates, you're not going to get all of the payday per se,
Sure.
right?
So in
So
that case, like if I'm like, it's $1 million house, I'm putting the 100 grand in, they're putting it, is the equity then split, like 90% goes to the equity partner and like the homeowner keeps the 10?
you got it. In a lot of ways, it's almost simpler than a mortgage. Mortgages can be really,
It's way
really
simpler.
confusing, but we're so indoctrinated by it because this is what we learn when you're becoming an adult. You get a mortgage and this is how it works. But we've never really stopped to question, all right, are there any other options, right? Because there are a lot of solutions that are coming out that are trying to shave a little bit off the side, right? Hey, we'll help you with your down payment cost or closing costs, or lower the interest rate by this fraction or that fraction. They're not making a real difference. We need to really question the core fundamental thing that we're using to drive this process.
So, have you guys identified sort of what the sweet spot is for you in terms of like the purchase price of the house? Is it like $500,000 homes is like where you guys can sort of realize the best sort of terms, whereas also like the best sort of growth for equity over like a 10-year period?
Yeah, so you've got a marketplace, and we're kind of building this marketplace. And you have two sides. You have the private equity, whether that be a smaller investor or whether it's Blackstone and Bain, on one side. They're the ones with the cash, the one that want to own that real estate equity, right? And then you have the buyer. And the pairing of these two is a lot more efficient than having them compete, right? When you go to buy a home right now, you might be competing with private equity for that home because they're going out and buying up this asset class, right? We all hear those horror
Saw that
stories.
my
And
neighbor did that. They put their house up sale and somebody bid
yep.
on it, and it was back in the Zillow fiasco when Zillow was coming over and paying way too much for everything.
And to the point where Congress is talking about we should ban this, right? We shouldn't let private equity own these residential homes. Well, here's the problem. Private equity is the only one with the amount of money it takes to buy all these things, right? So either the prices need to get cut in half to meet the purchasing power of the people who actually want to live in them, which we all know is going to basically cut the net worth in half of everybody over the age of 40, right? And nobody wants that. So what they're trying to say is Congress says, well, we just won't let private equity buy these things. Well, you might end up causing that collapse in price and the net worth of all these people, which some people might be for. However, I think the more reasonable and free market way to do that is let those two parties partner rather than compete. So the private equity gets the relationship they want. They want the equity. They don't really want the work of being in the property, keeping it in good shape, doing all those things, and then having to rent it out, making sure it's occupied, and then be there when things happen and set up all these rules and right. So we're outsourcing that to the person who actually wants to be in the property, right? Let them own a sliver and let private equity own what they own, and put these people on the same team rather than as opponents. So with that in mind, to answer your question, the sweet spot per se early on in this process is going to be whatever private equity wants, right? They're the 90% part of the equation.
That's a good answer.
So basically what they're going to want to see is, you know, areas that have historic asset appreciation, right? If they're in this thing for 5 years or more, they want to see location, location, location that's going to do well. They also want to see buyers of record, people who are quality buyers, maybe professional buyers rather than your first time home buyers, right? So we're trying to start this on solid footing. And that also includes higher down payments, right? Because that down payment means that person is more invested in that property. They're going to take care of it. So the other mechanism I should mention is those buyers, the custodian of the asset, the person living in it who has to keep it in good condition, they're the ones that take any first losses on things like if 5 years from now the property goes to disrepair, right? And it's going to sell on the market for way less. They need to be on the hook first because they're the ones that let the property descend into chaos. So things like that, the sweet spot would be probably higher value properties, closer to the $1 million valuation in locations that are going to do well over time and appreciate with buyers who are buyers of record and good buyer, good credit scores, et cetera, with higher down payments. So that doesn't sound like we're helping many people at all, right? But in order to get this thing off the ground and rolling in a way that scales and to a place where private equity trusts it, the market trusts it, and buyers trust it, then we can start, you know, really pushing the boundaries of what the market wants. And there's a lot of private equity groups who said, hey, we'll take a 5% down if, you know, we have XYZ metrics that we think are going to, it's going to meet. And these are what the payments are. So we can help those people eventually. But the first thing we got to do is make sure that we get this with a solid track record built in the right way.
Well, it's fascinating though, because as a homeowner, then like for me, I'm coming in and I'm going, hey, great. I can, you know, I want to get in this $1 million home, but I only have to put 150 down instead of, I think 20 is typical, right?
You're right.
But then I'm looking at it going, now I'm going to stay there for 10 years and I'm going to sell and I'm going to move. But even then at that point, at the end of that 10 years, I'm still going to be walking away with, you know, roughly, you know, whatever that it is, but without the like crazy insane loss for all the mortgage payments I would have made that whole decade.
Right. You can only lose what you put up, right? Yeah. So in some sense, a lot of people who bought in that financial crisis in 2008 or prior, they were underwater in mortgages, right? They're paying debt on a property at the level of like $1 million
when
the
property is only 500 and it dropped to 150. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So you avoid that, right? You're kind of with offloading some of that upside. You're also offloading a lot of the risk, right? That asset price risk. So the way we describe it on our website, I think, is basically pay what you have now and you pay the rest when you sell. So when the property sells, that's when private equity gets their share back.
Such a good tagline. So, all right. So you're moving to the Bay, like, but what's your vision for listed then? Let's say this sort of vision out, like, you know, 5 years, we're in 2030. What's your vision for where you hope listed is at that point?
I think at that point, people are going to start considering equity as a viable option for purchasing large assets way more than they do today. I wish that it weren't. I don't necessarily love the idea of debt anyways, right? However, we are creating this out of necessity because asset prices are out of reach, right? I wish it were a problem that we didn't have to solve, but we do. I would say, I hope that 5 years from now, people are looking at, hey, I don't want to buy with a bank. That's, you know, over 30 years, I'm going to pay $2.5 million on $1 million property. That doesn't seem smart. Why don't I be responsible about this and finance this by paying what I can now and getting a, you know, getting a payment that I can afford, right? That helps me get into maybe a better house than I otherwise would. But I think people will see us as a legitimate option, as an alternative to debt, right? There's a lot of people that debt will still make a lot of sense for, right? There's a lot of reasons why debt has dominated for so long and it came about. You know, I would see us in 5 years starting to breach that ability to now help some of the first-time home buyers, start to help people who are basically priced out of the market. But I do think these first couple of years are going to be focused on professional property managers, people who, or maybe smaller companies that own and operate homes. And you know, it gives the private equity, you know, a buyer of record, someone with a reputation that they can trust, that's done this before. And I think as we get going, I think the trust will open up. I think private equity will start to say, "Hey, this asset's doing really well. It's really low maintenance. We don't have to do anything. There's tax benefits involved. We can trade the equity, which means if I'm a private equity company, I own 90% of the home. I can maybe trade 4 or 5% of that home the same way I trade a stock, right?" So they're going to build their portfolios with
So fascinating.
diversified homes, right?
Wow.
So that's where we're going. But I think it's gonna take a little bit of you know, really a lot of work doing things like this to get the word out and have people become comfortable with equity as a method of financing, right? Entrepreneurs are because they're familiar with it, but not everyday people. And so there's a lot of learning curve there that we're gonna need to
Yeah.
attack.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right. So somebody's listening to this, they're super fascinated. Maybe they want to engage, be one of your customers. How do they find you? What's the best way to, you know, get involved and listed in your world?
Yeah, listed.us, listid.us is our site. And my information, if you wanted to email me personally, feel free to reach out. It's norman.desilva@gmail.com. That's my personal email address. Happy to share that with you guys. Feel free to reach out. Other than that, yeah, just start really talking about equity, whether it be in conversations with your friends at dinner parties, with people who maybe do have the means to try to affect change in this way. And yeah, I think if there's a way you can connect us and help us out with a network introduction opportunity, something like that, you know, we're more than willing, and we're all ears. So we're trying to get this in front of as many people as possible that, you know, identify this problem the same way we do and really want to kind of fix it. And you know, we're only one small group here, so we're going to need some people on in our army, so to speak,
Yeah,
trying to
I
help
love it.
solve this with us.
Well, good thing you know your way around coaching. All
Yeah.
right, Norman, thanks so much for your time. This has been an amazing conversation.
Absolutely. I appreciate you having me.